Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
In our house, it began one afternoon when Maya was three. We were sitting on the floor of my office, sifting through a bag of photos from my childhood. I was sorting pictures from the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s into separate stacks when she withdrew one from the center pile. "Who's that?" she asked. She pressed the tip of her chubby index finger into the center of a foggy Instamatic square. I angled my neck to see the photo in her hand. It was a slightly out-of-focus shot of my mother from the shoulders up. She was wearing a pink and green striped sweater, and the camera had caught her mid-sentence. A pair of brown construction paper rabbit ears rested on top of her short, frosted hair. I remembered the afternoon that photo was taken. We were standing in the carpool lane of my elementary school after my sister's third-grade play, and my mother was warning me not to take a picture of her with rabbit ears on her head. After I'd snapped the shot anyway, she'd just shrugged and smiled and said, "Well, that'll be a winner." I flipped the picture over. On the back, my mother had written, "March 1977. "That's my mommy," I said. My mommy. The words sounded both odd and comforting in my own voice after all those years. Maya's little face scrunched up in confusion. I could almost see the tiny mental gears straining to click into place. "Daddy has a mommy, and I know who she is. But Mommy has a mommy, too?" "Why can't I see her?" she asked. "Because," I said, and then I stopped short. This was the conversation I'd been waiting to have, the one I'd been rehearsing since before her birth. I wanted my child to know about my mother, to know what she'd represented and believed in, and I didn't want to obfuscate the truth about her absence, no matter how scary or painful it might be. I'd decided long ago to wait for Maya to ask, and then to gently and informatively explain. But in the movie version of my life, we were curled up together on the couch in a shared moment of reverence, not sprawled across the mauve carpet surrounded by random misfiled scraps of my past. In the big screen version, Maya would ask, "What happened to your mother?" And my answer would spill forth like a clear, sparkling stream released from its source. Instead, at the critical moment of response, I couldn't find any words at all.
That was a selection from Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become, read by the author, Hope Edelman. From a parent's perspective, what is the significance of a mom's youthful loss of her own mother? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has had her own experiences with loss of her mother at a young age and has researched some of the manifestations to share with others. Hope Edelman is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Motherless Daughters, and its companion volume, Letters from Motherless Daughters. When she became a parent, she found herself revisiting the loss of her mother when she was 17 in ways she had never anticipated. Now the mother of two young girls, she set out to learn how the loss of a mother to death or abandonment can affect the ways women raise their own children. Her new book, Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become, examines eight themes that cut across racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Hope.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
What did you find was the biggest myth about moms who have lost their own mothers?
Well, I would say that it was the idea that because they hadn't received adequate mothering or consistent mothering, that they would not then be able to mother their own children adequately or consistently. And that turned out to be not true at all. In fact, in all of the research done on motherless mothers, they show up as engaged, devoted, really active mothers who, in fact, even overcompensate because of what they feel they didn't get or don't have. So they often felt that they wouldn't know how to be a mother. They, in fact, were eight times more likely than other women to say they were afraid they wouldn't know how to be a mother. But, in fact, they became extraordinary mothers in most cases.
What helped them, the ones that became extraordinary mothers or even good, competent mothers, what did you find helped them to do that since they felt they didn't have a model?
Well, interestingly enough, they felt they couldn't mother because they didn't have a living role model. So instead of drawing from their own childhood with their mothers or memories of their mothers, which many of them didn't have if they were quite young when their mothers died, instead somehow their loss experience help them create a sense of guiding principles as a mother. So they would say, "I want to become the mother I didn't get to have." And that meant a mother who was active and engaged and there for her children. Of course, that also meant being a mother who lives throughout the child's childhood and adolescence. Mm-hmm. But it also made them feel like, I'd like to be the kind of mother who is attentive to her child, who is affectionate with her child, so that the child will always know that they were loved. Because many of them felt that, well, you know, my mother may have only lived for 8 or 9 years of my life. She didn't know she was going to die. She had a lot of children. You know, I didn't always feel loved, even though I must have been. She didn't tell me that she loved me. So they're very conscious about telling their children that they love them, about being attentive to their children's distress in a way that they may have felt their mother wasn't to them.
It's interesting that they wouldn't have pulled upon living role models like, you know, Aunt Jane or somebody, the neighbor or somebody
right.
that they were close to. But those were not significant models for them.
Well, that was surprising because these women were not always devoid of good maternal role models. They may have had an older sister who already had children or an aunt or a grandmother who even had helped raise them after their mother died. But the feeling was, if my mother's not here, then I am missing the primary guide for motherhood.
What was the most unexpected result of becoming a mom when you lost your own mother?
I had written Motherless Daughters, so I had done a lot of grief work and a lot of research and writing and felt that I was very prepared to make the transition into motherhood and had a handle on how my own motherlessness would factor in. What surprised me was how profoundly I missed my mother after my first daughter was born. I really thought that I had done all the grief work that I could do up to that point. And what I didn't bargain for was how profound that transition is and how much women think about their mothers at that time, how much they will miss them if they're not there. And part of it is childcare. I was in a mommy and me group, and most of the women there had their mothers come in to help them postpartum or had their mothers to call on the phone. Or in our prenatal group, the women could call their mothers and say, what was your labor like? What was your delivery like? What was I like as a newborn? I didn't have access to that information. So there were, all that was missing. But there was just this need as a new mother to be mothered. I didn't expect that at all. I was so self-confident and competent and self-sufficient. You know, as a woman without a mother, I'd really learned how to take care of myself. What surprised me was how much I longed to be taken care of in those first few weeks postpartum. Mm-hmm. And even though, again, I had maternal role models to help me, a cousin flew in from Australia for 2 weeks, my mother-in-law came for a month, because they weren't my mother, I didn't feel cared for in that very special way.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on motherless mothers.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Hope Edelman, author of Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become.
How does the grieving process, when, of course, it happened years before,
right.
affect how you actually parent?
Well, in most cases, the women that I interviewed had not grieved before. There was a surprising number of women who said that the birth of their first child was the trigger for their mourning because they hadn't, as children, felt that they were in a safe and supportive environment to grieve. They may have been left with a surviving caretaker who was very fragile, and they felt if they grieved, that person would fall apart, which is not true, but that's the child's magical thinking. If I fall apart, then my father or my grandmother will fall apart, and then who will take care of me? So they stuff those feelings. If they had grieved in the past, it tended to be reactivated, as it was in my case, but many of them had not grieved in the past. And in fact, we do know from the attachment literature that it's the unmourned loss that affects the parent-child relationship more so than the loss per se. If a woman lost a mother and grieved that loss at some point prior to becoming a mother, she has a very different outcome with her child than the mother who hasn't mourned her loss, who is more likely to have attachment difficulties with her children and have children who are, I wouldn't say they're not bonded to their mothers, because they are, but they tend to be a little insecurely attached to their mothers. They can't quite read their mother's signals because she's responding in many cases to internal triggers rather than to the external environment. So just to give you an example, if a mother's on a playground and she sees her child falling off the monkey bars. It's a natural response to go run and help that child out of the sand or try to catch the child before the child slips and falls. But in the motherless mother, just seeing the child on the monkey bars can trigger a fear in her that her child will get hurt, that someone she loves will be hurt or possibly taken from her in some way again. And she's the mother on the playground who has her hands underneath the child when the child is safely climbing on the monkey bars. And so the message the child gets is, since the child doesn't see anything dangerous in the environment, the message the child gets is, it's not safe to explore. It's not safe to climb and use my own motor skills.
Everything's scary.
Right.
Yeah, a tremendous overprotectiveness.
Right. Like. And in some cases, if the loss had been unmourned, yes, that was a likely result.
We've had conversations a number of times with grief counselors, and there are different times to pull them in for different situations. And one of the things that we keep hearing is that different events in your life, anyone's life, can trigger revisiting whatever the grief situation was, and you revisit it in a different way because you're at a different stage.
That's exactly right. And if you're a motherless daughter, there are pretty predictable trigger moments. They will be a graduation. You know, when you're stepping from one chapter of your life into a next. Well, moving backwards, if you lost your mother when you were quite young, menstruation is usually a time when women really miss having the support or guidance of their mother, assuming they had a mother who would have been supportive. Not all girls or women do have that kind of relationship with even a living mother. But it would be menstruation, high school graduation, college graduation, first job, marriage, of course, because there's such a prescribed role for mothers of the bride in this society, and the transition to motherhood. But that's the big one. The big one is the transition to motherhood. When women become the person they have lost, it's a very predictable time for the grief to bubble up again and for women to have to work through it. Also, what happens when you become a mother is that you see the world through the eyes of a mother for the first time. You simply cannot do that until you have that first child in your arms. And when they look at the world through the eyes of a mother, they can envision their mother's experience in a way they couldn't possibly have before. Women told me, when I held my baby and looked at my baby and felt how much I loved my baby, I knew that my mother had once felt that way about me. And it never really occurred to me before that she felt so strongly about her children until I had one of my own. But they also see how much their mother lost by dying young, and that can make them very, very sad.
Are there special stages in a child's development that trigger issues of mother loss in moms?
That would depend a lot on what moments in the mother's history she had felt the loss of her mother most painfully. If she was 6, 7, 8 years old, let's say, and her mother wasn't there when she got her first period, she may see her daughter going through that, and at the same time that she feels very sad for the child she once was, because that's what happens. You look back, you see your child going through a stage that you had to go through and felt very lonely, very sad, very isolated, very bereft. You see your child go through that stage, and perhaps your child's going through it fine because you're there, but you identify with the child that you once were. But what it also does in these women is it makes them very, very committed to helping their child through those moments so that their child will not feel sad or lonely or bereft. So the motherless mother might be the one waiting outside the door with the box of tampons, you know, with giving instructions to her daughter because she so wants to be there for her daughter, not just to help her daughter, but it heals that child inside of herself.
So you can heal yourself absolutely. By doing things for your child.
It can be an enormously healing experience for these women because they are able to do for their child what wasn't done for them, and it heals the child within themselves. It's like a kind of reparenting, in a sense, reparenting that childlike version of yourself. But the risk that these women run is that sometimes they wind up parenting the younger version of themselves instead of the child they have. They look at the child, they project their own memories of a lonely or sad time in their life onto the child, and they try to fix that child, their own childlike distress, when it actually would be better for their child to have a little bit of disappointment, to have a little bit of frustration or anxiety, and learn how to overcome it by themselves rather than having their mother rush in to make it better.
What are some of the constants that mothers who have lost their own moms tend to experience?
Well, these women tended to be more intense and focused on certain areas of parenting than other women were. In fact, they do parent differently than other women in some ways. And some of the common areas in which they were more sensitive than other women was the fear of dying young, the concern about leaving a child motherless. As we talked about not knowing how to be a mother, they were much more likely. And also, they were concerned about being able to parent a child beyond the age they were when their mother died because they lacked the personal experience. This was a big issue for women whose children were on the brink of adolescence. They'd say, I didn't have a mother through my teenage years. I don't know what a mother-daughter relationship is like for a teenager. How will I know how to be a mother to my child? And then you speak with women who are on the other side of that experience, and they say, well, you know your child. You know, you get through it. You manage. And sometimes it's freeing or liberating not to have a role model from the past of motherhood during those years, because you're free to invent your own form of motherhood and your own relationship with your child.
Yeah, I was curious about expectations. You don't have those expectations that you think the older generation would have from you.
But on the other hand, a lot of these women who didn't go through a mother-daughter struggle during adolescence found themselves very confused and very upset when their own child started pushing against them. One woman in the book even said, I couldn't relate at all to my daughter's need to push me away or reject me. All I ever wanted was a mother who was alive. How could she not want me all of the time? I spent all those years longing for my mother, and she doesn't want me. I don't know how to handle that. This was a big issue for those women. And that's when mothers' groups, good therapists, good friends to talk to can be really helpful.
We haven't talked about boys at all. Is it different parenting boys when you're a motherless mom?
That's an interesting question. A high percentage of women, almost three-quarters of the women that I interviewed in person, said that they had hoped for a girl when they were pregnant for the first time because they wanted to recapture the mother-daughter relationship. And what they didn't understand, not being a mother themselves, is how close mothers can be with their sons. And really what they wanted was the mother-child relationship. 50% of them gave birth to boys and discovered that they felt very close to their sons. Nobody ever said, I wish that my boy had been a girl, or vice versa. There were some women who, a small but notable number of women, who wanted to have sons because they felt they didn't have what it took to raise a daughter. Their mothers, when alive, had been either abusive or neglectful, or their mothers had died when they were young and they felt they didn't get what a girl needed from a mother, so they wouldn't be able to pass it on. So they hoped to have boys. Now, 50% of them had girls and discovered that it was wonderful to raise girls as well. But having a daughter does give you a more direct route to replicating the mother-daughter relationship you once had or didn't get to have, because you will help your daughter through a certain set of gendered experiences that you had yourself, like menstruation, like the first date, like shopping for a prom dress. Many things that these women may have done alone, they now get to do with the daughter. So in some ways, it's a more direct route to repairing the part of themselves that was hurt or broken in the past.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on motherless mothers.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Hope Edelman, author of Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become.
Does it mean that the grieving process that goes on when you're doing the self-repairing and all this is different when you have a boy?
I think it is. It happens nonetheless, or regardless of the child's gender. But I do think that having a daughter does give women access to a little deeper grief experience, if I could say. And, you know, I have only girls, so it's hard for me to say. I can say that it's been very reparative for me. But I've spoken with hundreds of women, and they seem to say the same thing. Although the women with sons find that they are able to really have a restorative experience as well, or a reparative experience. But I do think that you can just go a little deeper with girls because you will be reliving some of the experiences that you did have as a mother that you can't quite get at with sons.
Hope, how do mothers cope when there is no maternal grandmother for their kids, the issue that you were dealing with when we first began in that story?
Right. Well, that was another loss that I hadn't quite anticipated to experience when my daughter was born, because I had been focused on everything that I had lost. I didn't have a mother, and everything my mother had lost, she didn't get to see me have this child or know this child. But then I had a daughter, and I started thinking about all my daughter had lost. Look at that. She doesn't have a maternal grandmother. My husband's mother is alive, but she lives 8,000 miles away. So functionally, my children don't have a grandmother for most of each year because they only get to see her about once every year and a half or 2 years for a short period of time. So I thought, gee, what has she lost? This ability to have another home to go to where she uniquely belongs, and an alternate maternal viewpoint in the family, the ability to have a relationship with someone of an older generation. I'm 41 years old. My kids think I'm old because they don't have another generation. You know, they don't have interaction with many women who are older than me. Some of the women that I spoke with for the book very actively looked for grandmother substitutes for their children, especially if they didn't have a mother-in-law who was present, alive, or involved in the family. It was a hole in the family that I'd never felt before because I never had a child. And of course, there's the lack of practical support, like helping with babysitting and infant care and all of those things that we hope grandmas like to do and children enjoy as well. But for these women, it was really more the loss of emotional support as a mother. That person who could say to them, it's going to be okay. I know it's hard right now, but this too shall pass. And you will move on to the next phase. And I got through it. And here's what you were like at this age. And here's how I handled it. And it's that advice and emotional support that they miss having from someone who knew them when they were young.
What advice do you have for motherless moms about discussing the issue of death with their own kids? It's so loaded.
Oh, it is. And this is a big issue for these women because they have to introduce their children to the concept of death and the idea that mothers can die when their children are young. At a very early age, because usually children will start asking about their grandmothers at age 2 or 3, just like my daughter did. That's when the questions usually begin. 75% of the women I interviewed have pictures of their mothers on display in their home, and it's inevitable at some point the child will point at the picture and say, who's that? And then you will answer, my mother. And the child will say something like, my daughter, why can't I see her? Why don't I know her? Where is she? And then you have to talk about death. It really depends on how old the child is and the child's level of cognition. In fact, in chapter 8 in the book, I break down the children by developmental stages and say, this is how much a child can understand at this age. Typically, here's the kinds of questions they're likely to ask. Here's what you should say in response. Some of the women are reluctant to discuss the mother's death with their children because it may have happened in a very traumatic way. It may have been a suicide. It may have been a murder. It may have been a death they witnessed. They don't want to upset or scare their children. And because they don't know how to talk about it, they won't. Mm-hmm. And then the child will grow up with questions, but they'll also grow up with the sense that it's not safe to ask these questions. It will upset my mother. It's not that they're not curious. It's that they've learned not to ask. I advocate being as honest as you can with your child, as you're comfortable being, and to give the child as much information as you feel the child can handle cognitively and emotionally. So the answer to that question is know your child, watch your child, see how much you think they can handle, because you can give them a little bit more information each year. My mother died of breast cancer, and when my daughter was, my 8-year-old was quite young, it was just enough for her to know that my mother died of cancer. She knew it was something that made people sick. But she's asking more sophisticated questions now as she gets older. Not long ago, she wanted to know exactly how my mother died. And I said, well, she had breast cancer. And she said, I know that. But how did something in her breast make her whole body stop living? And so we needed to talk at a more sophisticated level about how that could happen. And at some point, she'll be asking more sophisticated questions about what happens after you die, now that she understands what death means. Now, my 4-year-old doesn't quite yet understand what death means. Just a week and a half ago in the kitchen, she said to me, what happens when you die? And I said, well, I believe, and your father believes, that your soul goes to another place. Your body stays here on earth, but your soul goes somewhere else, and you get to see all the people who've died before you. That's what we believe and what we teach our children. And she said, well, but what if you die and then you wake up? She doesn't understand yet that death is irreversible, which is completely consistent with a 4-year-old's cognitive ability. Mm-hmm. So she's right where she should be. But I need to talk with her about it in a way that a 4-year-old can understand. She can listen to the conversations I have with my 8-year-old. She's not quite there yet, though. So I need to have different explanations for my different children.
But you have to reply. You have to give an answer that's truthful.
I believe you have to. I think that honesty with children in this regard is absolutely the best policy.
Is it helpful for parents who haven't gone on that journey yet to talk about death with their children to talk to either somebody older and wiser or a professional or somebody so they get a reality check before they embark on this sort of loaded discussion?
Well, I think a child will start asking out of natural curiosity. And if you haven't yet had a death in the family, you can wait until the child asks. I mean, young children will see a dead bug or a dead animal, or maybe lose a pet, or maybe a neighbor's or a friend's grandparent will die. And they'll, out of curiosity, start asking questions. And that's the time to start giving them the information that they're requesting. I don't see any reason to introduce the concept earlier. Although children who watch Disney movies, for example, may have questions about dead mothers before
all the mothers
they
die.
Experience it. It is, you know, in inimitable Disney fashion. The motherless character is dominant, yeah.
Hope, in addition to your book, Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become, what resources could you suggest for our listeners who want to go beyond today's conversation?
There are a couple of other books that I recommend. One is Maxine Harris's The Loss That Is Forever. She has a chapter on parenting in there that actually talks about losing a mother or father at an early age, whether you're a daughter or son. So if you know a fatherless son or a motherless son or any other combination, that's a good chapter. There's also a book called Mothering Without a Map for women whose mothers were alive but were neglectful or abusive or addicted or not capable of mothering them properly. She calls these women unmothered. That's a large population, unfortunately, in our culture. There's also a website, motherlessmothers.com, where women can go and click on an interactive map of the United States and see if there's a support group near them. There are motherless daughters and motherless mothers support groups starting all over the world, in fact, and I have the international ones as well. But in the United States, they can click on their state, see if there's a group near them that they can join, because it's the support of other women and the advice of other women who understand their unique situation that I think is most helpful.
Hope Edelman, you have been most helpful to all of us to help us understand a unique situation and one that we hope will bring some help to other mothers going through this. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Hope Edelman's book, Motherless Mothers, How Mother Loss Shapes the Parents We Become. Just call us toll free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. And mention show number 295. Please tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we air all over the world, it's fun to know where you're tuning in. Our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available in all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. At the site, you can even hear a show at any time. Just click on Listen to Podcast beneath the topic and guest that you want to hear. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.